You're listening to the Douglas Jacoby Podcast. Here we bring you some of the material found on Douglas's website in podcast form. We hope that as you listen, you are challenged to think about faith. Today, Douglas continues his series on the paranormal, now looking at out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences. For more on this episode, follow the link in the show notes to Douglas's website. Now, here's today's teaching.
Thanks for listening to this podcast on out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences. What I'm sharing with you is a draft form of a chapter for my new book on heaven and hell. My Swedish tutor was a rational person, fluent in Russian, German, French, English, and Swedish. Birgitta was sensible and modest, intelligent too, just like her husband. During our 3 years in Stockholm, we learned a lot about one another. I knew her medical history and her battles with cancer, her political and philosophical views. She was not a believer, so when she told me that she had been declared clinically dead in hospital, but had come back, I didn't have any reason to suspect deceit, psychosis, or error. Something happened. She wasn't out of her mind, just out of her body. And she's hardly alone. And like most who have had out-of-body or near-death experiences, she proceeded through a dark tunnel towards the light, but was sent back, not permitted to stay in the blissful place. I think for most of you listening to this lesson, the sequence is familiar. The sense of death is accompanied by a sense of well-being, disembodiment, visions of persons, events, objects, a tunnel leading to light, interactions with other beings, whether they are human or divine, a new evaluation of one's life, and then returning to life. Most of this can be explained by the drop in oxygen levels in the brain, the buildup of carbon dioxide, reduction in neural firing, a shutdown of the visual cortex, euphoria triggered by dopamine and endorphins in the brain. And even though the sequence is familiar and much of this can be explained medically, scientifically, I don't think that these explanations take us all the way. On the lighter side, an acquaintance of my proofreader was in the hospital, and he said, "I actually did see the bright light everyone talks about when describing near-death experiences. When I awoke from the 18-second flatline after being resuscitated, I told the nurses. And then I looked up and realized that the bright light was, in fact, the bright light over my bed that shined in my eyes when they laid the bed flat to do CPR. Well, sometimes the explanations make sense and they account adequately for what's happened, but not necessarily. Tens of thousands of the living have had experiences of a world beyond this one, and quite a few are well documented. Some clung to life, others were given up for dead, and not a few were brain dead. In 2001, there was a study of 350 patients in The Lancet. That's the world's oldest medical journal, and certainly one of the most respected, the British periodical. And physician Pim van Lommel discovered a number of near-death experiences, and we can call these NDEs, and even after brain function had ceased, some experienced what they understood to be heaven, others the opposite, while some experiences were devoid of religion altogether. In a few cases, the blind were able to see. Subjects met dead relatives, and sometimes they beheld angels, demons, and God himself. NDEs and other phenomena that transport the subject to the world beyond are what we're focusing on here. They're an accepted part of popular culture, and the biblically informed will be asked what they think about NDEs. So I wonder, do you have an opinion about this? Have you had any direct or indirect experience? We're going to take a look at five highly publicized cases. Four of the journeys were heavenly, one hellish. A friend and fellow author has met several persons who've experienced burning flames in their near-death experiences. And as many authors conclude, not all NDEs are peaceful events. There have been actually many recent works on out-of-body and near-death experiences. We're going to be talking about five, but there are a number of others. For example, Richard Sigmund's My Time in Heaven, Denis Anolian Prince's 9 Days in Heaven, Mark Baker's A Divine Revelation of Hell, and Kevin and Alex Malarkey, The Boy Who Came Back from Heaven. All of these have been published in the last 3 years. Anyway, I hope that a quick peek at the five cases I've selected, each of which also results in a best-selling book, will provide an opportunity to apply a balanced biblical perspective to the common range of NDEs in contemporary culture. Case one, Don Piper, and his book is 90 Minutes in Heaven. Don Piper, who's no relation to theologian John Piper, who some of you will know, died in a grisly car crash and spent 90 minutes in heaven. Piper recognized many of the deceased he saw in heaven. Interestingly, all the people he encountered during his near-death experiences were the same age as when he last saw them. I mention this because in many NDEs, people tend to be younger. They tend to appear younger than they were at the time of death. Piper notices several details that match the traditional picture of heaven, like pearlescent gates and streets of gold. His account has the ring of truth, though, as he admits, he didn't reveal all the details until nearly 2 years after the accident. But if he told no one about his experience for many months, how can he be sure he didn't experience it later, so to speak, especially during the times he was so heavily medicated? Now, I'm not doubting that Piper had a significant experiences, but only calling into question whether the details were all remembered or possibly synthesized. At any rate, I regard Piper's story as having more credibility than most. Case two, Chu Thomas. Her book, Heaven is So Real, came out a couple years after Piper, actually a year before Piper's. In 03, Thomas considers herself to be an end times prophetess. God began speaking directly to her in 1995, and she was specially selected by Jesus to accompany him on weekly visits to heaven, which typically followed a period of bodily convulsion. In heaven, she says that she beheld streets of gold and literal mansions, and I emphasize that because that shows that she's misunderstood the archaic sense of the word mansions in the King James Version, because it's talking about rooms or dwelling places, not mansions. But in her visions, they're large houses. And there are also beach houses. She says that God wants us all to have a beach house. But for one who takes Revelation so literally as she does, what about Revelation 21:1? There's no more sea. If there's no more sea, then how could you have a beach house? I think that's silly, but I'm simply coming down to the literalistic level. Chu Thomas has also visited her own personal mansion with her name engraved on a golden plaque. A silver bathtub is there, and velvet chairs. Thomas goes into tedious detail about what she has seen. And that makes me think of Colossians 2:18-19. And I think it's worth reading this. And again, the purpose of this lesson is not to cast aspersions on all of these experiences. I do think that Thomas's is especially incredible. That is, you really cannot believe it happened, in my opinion. But I want us to think biblically about these. In Colossians 2, the Apostle Paul says, "Let no one disqualify you, insisting on asceticism and the worship of angels, going on in detail about visions, puffed up without reason by his sensuous mind, not holding fast to the head, from whom the whole body, nourished and knit together through its joints and ligaments, grows with the growth that is from God." Paul, in other words, talks about someone who's drifted from Christ and really the heart of the gospel into a world of experiences and stories and outdoing other people's stories. The Jesus that she met, Thomas, endorsed December 25th as his birthday, even though we know the date has almost certainly come into Christianity from paganism. Her visions also support other features of her personal theology: strict tithing, a premillennial rapture, speaking in tongues, laughing in the spirit. She's informed that a war will begin in 1998. She's told that we should eat fish, and God speaks King James English. He purposes to make her rich so that she can bless others, and Jesus assures her that she is a beautiful woman. As Thomas admits throughout the book, she rejects all suggestions that she's anything less than a prophetess, or that the heavenly dances Jesus taught her to perform should not be performed in the churches where she visits and speaks. It's difficult for me not to conclude that she is highly narcissistic. When an NDE clearly contradicts Scripture or mainstream biblical scholarship, warning bells should begin to ring. We know that the Bible's true. We don't know that a particular report of an NDE is true, so the Bible must always take precedence over an NDE account, no matter how much we want to believe it. Well, if her story is so lacking in biblical credibility, and really, if you read this book, I found hundreds of examples in the book, which I put into my notes, which I spare you. But if it really is so egregiously bad, why do I mention it? Well, because it is endorsed by David Yonggi Cho. He's senior pastor of the largest church in the world, the Yeouido Full Gospel Church in Korea. Membership 1 million. Cho said he was deeply impressed and inspired by it. Cho agrees that Sister Chu Thomas traveled to heaven with Jesus several times and he took her sightseeing in heaven. I have received a lot of insight about heaven and have been blessed. Among religious books, it has become the number one bestseller in Korea. Well, that's what David Yonggi Cho says. I suspect that one reason it's become a bestseller is that he, and that would lead to hundreds of thousands or millions of sales alone. Let's go to case three, Colton Burpo. The book is Heaven is for Real, which came out in 2010. Now, our third story is somewhat more credible than the last one. Todd Burpo, who's Colton's father, is a Christian pastor, highly personable. He shares a lot from his own life, and he repeatedly emphasizes how he and his wife tried not to lead their little boy on, not to put words in his mouth. The story was written by the father of three-year-old Colton, 3 years and 10 months, I believe. And he underwent emergency appendix surgery. Under anesthesia, he never died, but he had recollections of a heavenly visit, which he shared with his parents over the next few years. At first, the little boy rose above his body, a common experience during surgeries and NDEs. He had knowledge of his parents praying for him and of his mother being on the telephone and their being in separate rooms. According to the little boy, his visit to heaven lasted 3 minutes. And when you read the book, you think that an entire day's activities were crammed into those 3 minutes. The boy recognized the father. That's capital F. The father who was really big, quote, end quote. The Holy Spirit, and of course, Jesus, who loves the little children. Jesus had a rainbow horse. He wore white clothes and a purple sash. There were red marks on his feet and palms. And later, the boy points out Jesus in a sketch by an artist, Akiane Kramarik. The sketch is called Prince of Peace. You can find it on the internet if you are motivated. In this picture, Jesus has light eyes and streaks in his hair, and his hair seems to be permed. He looks much more like an American than a Middle Easterner. And the sketch is actually included in the book, Heaven is for Real. There were other humans in heaven, especially children, many of whom Colton later names. They sported wings and halos, which sounds like something fresh out of the children's book, The Littlest Angel. The imagery of Revelation is literalized. There are thrones. Jesus is on the right side of God, the Archangel Gabriel on the left. Heaven is the new Jerusalem of Revelation 21:22. It's not on earth. Angels carry swords in heaven, and the Battle of Armageddon is going to be fought with swords and bows and arrows. And there are dogs in heaven, and two family members he meets that he had never met before. One is the dead sister, a fetus of 2 months at the time of the miscarriage. And he meets her, and this really tugs on the heartstrings of the reader, and especially the boy's mother. He also sees his deceased grandfather, though he's not able to explain that at first because it's a younger version of the man. And later, he recognizes his grandfather in a photo taken of the man when he was in his 30s. He didn't recognize him in the later pictures. Now, his mother was shocked because she hadn't thought that her father would be in heaven. She later learned that he had, quote, accepted Christ, end quote, 28 years before he died. Yet for the next three decades, he didn't manage to tell his family members about his conversion. Now, part of me wants to believe the boy isn't making it all up, that his mother hasn't prompted him. But this last detail made it impossible for me to accept. Jesus taught very clearly, if we're ashamed of him, he'll be ashamed of us. Mark 8:38. If we disown him, he will disown us. 2 Timothy 2:12. If his grandfather had become a true disciple of Christ, how could his own family members not know? The boy's experience, I think, had become a tool for parental sentimentality. Meaning, I think there were some unresolved feelings, and his mother really wanted to believe that her father died saved. The theology of heaven is for real reads as though it's taken out of a children's Sunday school workbook. A nearly four-year-old would have heard a great deal of talk about God in the Bible. It's not so easy to account for the details of the miscarried sister and the grandfather, assuming that they weren't planted. We weigh the work as a whole. We're not required to accept everything just because one or two details cannot be explained. But I don't find those accounts of the family members credible. The account repeatedly contradicts the testimony of the Old and New Testament and the early Christian writers. By placing people in heaven in the first place, it demonstrates little familiarity with the biblical teaching on the afterlife. The scriptures teach, John 3:13, no one has gone to heaven. No one will be in heaven until Jesus returns at the end of time. Similarly, no one's in hell. But what the book does show is familiarity with mainstream American evangelical teaching. In addition to the immediate transit to heaven, there's the literal Battle of Armageddon, the New Jerusalem, which is heaven, conversion through the sinner's prayer, and so forth. These are obviously not likely to appeal to other Protestants or Catholics or Orthodox or independent Christians. It's just evangelical teaching. And the author admits a history of mental illness in the family on his father's side. Perhaps that's relevant, I don't know. Although it's certainly a fascinating story in so many places, it feels hokey, though not as flagrant as the bizarre account of Chew Thomas that we saw before. So despite the often expressed opinion of the pastor father, I'm afraid the account does not impress me as celestial. Whatever little Colton experienced, it wasn't the visit to heaven. And sometime after I'd read the book, I learned, interestingly, the Burpos had approached my publishers who turned it down. I think that was a wise choice, not the part about over 3 million copies in print. I mean, their integrity for not publishing it. When I first read the book a couple years ago, I produced a podcast just on that topic. And if you're interested, you'll find that at this website as well. Let's go on to case four. Bill Wheezy, 23 Minutes in Hell, which came out in 03. The subject visits hell in a startlingly intense dream with follow-up visits or waking dreams. He's in a subterranean chamber at the center of the earth. I quote, I sense it to be approximately 3,700 miles deep, end quote. And there he was tormented by demons. The fire is literal. The details all come from the King James Version. And Wheezy has clearly misunderstood the Elizabethan English. In the King James Version, Sheol is mistakenly rendered as hell. He repeatedly mistakes Sheol for hell, and so he's conceived of hell as a pit. A literal prison with snakes and maggots and fires that torture the lost forever and where demons use the foulest profanity. His book promotes the idea that when the lost die, they proceed immediately to hell. I think that's its most serious error. But the misunderstandings of the King James Version and even just basic principles of interpretation led the author to make dozens of minor errors. The story is truly shocking, but it's only marginally scriptural. 23 Minutes in Hell, which shares publishers with Chew Thomas's book, is a New York Times bestseller as are pipers and burpos. Let's go on to the last case, case five, Eben Alexander, MD. Proof of Heaven. And at the time that I'm recording this podcast, his book is not out yet. It'll be out in a few days, I believe. Eben Alexander's case is unusual in that he is a neurosurgeon. And he's often spoken to patients emerging from comas. Dr. Alexander is well-versed in the NDE scenario, but only from the physician's side. And then after being stricken with acute bacterial meningitis, spending a week in a coma in 2008, his entire perspective was radically altered. He explains, first and foremost, near-death experiences and related mystical states of awareness reveal crucial truths about the nature of existence. And the reductive, materialist, physicalist model on which conventional science is based is fundamentally flawed. At its core, it intentionally ignores what I believe is the fundament of all existence, the nature of consciousness. That we know things beyond the ken of the normal channels is incontrovertible. An excellent resource for any scientist who still seeks proof of that reality is the rigorous 800-page analysis and review of all manner of extended consciousness, irreducible mind toward a psychology for the 21st century. This magnum opus from the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia catalogs a wide variety of empirical phenomena that appear difficult or impossible to accommodate within the standard physicalist way of looking at things. And when he says physicalist, he means the view that reality is only physical, the things that science can study. Phenomena covered include, in particular, NDEs occurring under conditions such as under deep anesthesia and cardiac arrest that, like my coma, should prevent occurrence of any experience whatsoever, let alone the profound sorts of experiences that frequently do occur. Also noteworthy, the American Institute of Physics sponsored meetings in 2006 and 2011 covering the physical science of such extraordinary channels of knowledge. The neurological community is in perfect position to recognize and collect the crucial reports of patients who survive journeys deep in coma from a variety of conditions. These reports will prove invaluable in further comprehending the nature of existence. But remember that patients tend not to report these unusual experiences unless specifically asked. So, says Dr. Alexander, we should ask them. Alexander insists that NDEs are not on the same level as visions or hallucinations, and the evidence is strong that he's correct in his assessment. I think that his testimony as a former skeptic is especially valuable. Okay, let me share a few further perspectives before we wrap up. Alexander's case, and probably Piper's, cannot be easily dismissed, and they force us to weigh each case on its own merits. In total, the first four books we discussed have sold about 9 million copies, and the fifth, I think, also will become a blockbuster. The public appetite for the transcendent is enormous, but the public needs truth, not speculation. Now, in all five cases, something happened. I wasn't especially interested in explaining away the stories, but often the details don't support biblical teaching, and I don't want others to be led astray. So moving on from these specific cases, what are we to make of NDEs and out-of-body experiences in general? It's well known that electrical stimulation of the brain's temporal lobe can generate a haunting experience, a sense of some presence, an alien presence. Several severe accidents, especially when there's head trauma and heart stoppage, can trigger the NDE. The NDE experience makes sense in terms of physiology. I mentioned before the common elements of the NDE, the disembodiment, the visions, the positive and sober evaluation of one's life. And most of that can be explained by the drop in oxygen levels, the buildup of CO2, reduction of neural firing, and so forth. Michael Shermer, president of the Skeptic Society, whom I've debated twice and I'll be having a dialogue with actually in a few days, he's an incredible skeptic. He underwent temporal lobe stimulation himself. Now, he's an agnostic, But he got himself hooked up. All the wires were attached to his head, and he had an NDE. Any direct connection with the afterlife seems unlikely. That's his conclusion. Science doesn't explain every detail in an NDE. For knowledge of events the subject could not have been directly aware of, but it should make us hesitate to assign a supernatural explanation. What am I saying? I think science can explain quite a bit. But just because science can explain part of what people experience doesn't invalidate their experience. It doesn't mean that there's nothing of God in it. It doesn't mean that it's impossible that they've gone beyond our world. For Christian writer and former White House policy analyst Dinesh D'Souza, whose own daughter had an NDE, the evidence is inconclusive. D'Souza admits that NDEs do not prove life after death because survival doesn't prove immortality. But it's clear that in some persons, consciousness lingers for a while after death. I mentioned D'Souza because I think his book on the afterlife is one of the best. It's called Life After Death. It's one of the best books at marshaling the combined evidence for life after death. I circled back to check with two men whose opinions I really respect. First, I approached Gary Habermas. He's an apologist, historian, and philosopher of religion, for his take. He hesitated to confirm the Burpo story, but he kept his options open. Habermas said, "I don't say we know exactly where NDEers may go, heaven or otherwise, but there's an incredible amount of evidence that something objective is happening." Habermas and his co-author, J.P. Moreland, note, "It makes sense that the identification of the figure will come from the patient's own background. For instance, no American claimed to have seen Shiva, Rama, or Krishna. So there are important reasons that certain factors of interpretation comment more on a person's beliefs, society, and culture than they do on the facts themselves." End quote. Neither author rejects NDEs or the supernatural. I'm talking about Habermas and his co-author Moreland. They're both Bible believers, yet the approach they take to NDEs is marked by caution not to draw unwarranted conclusions. The other person whose opinion I respect, I wanted to consult, was David Brousseau, who's an expert on early Christianity and a personal friend. And after he commented on the possibility of hallucination or fraud, Brousseau concluded that such NDE experiences generally contradict the evidence of the early church. In short, in the New Testament and the first three centuries of Christianity, there was a strong consensus that all the dead went to Hades, not heaven. And I believe that's the doctrine that we should be holding to now. So if I sum up, I will make 4 points in closing. NDEs are universal. They happen to members of every culture and religion. Second, the experiences tend to reflect the faith background of those undergoing them. Third, many but not all can be rationalized in terms of physiology or psychology. And fourth, NDEs are suggestive of a spiritual world and an afterlife. They strongly imply the former, though they do not prove the latter. I hope this has been interesting to you, and may we all keep an open mind with the right amount of skepticism as we try to apply God's word to real life situations.
We hope you enjoyed Douglas's teaching on the paranormal. For additional notes and resources, be sure to check out Douglas's website in the show notes. The website has hundreds of articles, podcasts, and videos for you to access for free. You can also become a premium subscriber and gain access to thousands of online resources from Douglas's teaching ministry. Thanks again for listening.